we decided that so many of these topics overlapped, like technology and theology, that may sound strange, that we would try and have somewhat integrated sessions. And we will do this without planning a great deal, just to make it more spontaneous. And so I'm David Bella, and I'm going to be the prime mover, I guess, of the first session. And why don't you tell a little bit what you're going to do in the next session, so they'll have a little bit in mind. No sense in me introducing this session, because we'll be doing it. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm Hans Walterholz, and tomorrow we're going to look at time. The slogan we picked was time as choice, and Dave is doing time as clock. As you may know, faculty come up here prepared to do something. You know, they bring up certain materials, and this just develops spontaneously. So between now and tomorrow morning, after what happens this morning, I will then try to pull some things together which I think are significant from our, let's say, a more theological perspective. And then Dave is going to be responding to me, as I will respond a little bit to him. My response, however, will not be the only one. It'll be more like a catalyst for your response.
Right. That's the way. So we're not quite sure what's going to happen. And that's what makes it kind of nice.
Yeah.
Okay, what I want to do to start out is I want you to think about your own behavior, and a particular kind of behavior, the behavior that you just take for granted, that you never think much about, and it just comes naturally to you. And I'm referring to the use of clocks. Okay? Now I see about half the people here have these devices. Yes, have these devices strapped to their bodies. That's what it is. Is there's this special thing that's strapped to your body, and they peer over the rooms that we're in. They look over even our bedsides. They're everywhere, and. Let's reflect a little bit on what happens with regard to this device that we have here. What does a clock do? Somebody want to kick in? I mean, we got to think on our experience. Okay, what does a clock do? Gets you up in the morning. Okay, what else does a clock do?
Well, it sets your pace.
Sets your pace. Okay. Huh?
Pass the time.
Counts the time. Measures the time. Defines the school day.
Gets you to church
on time. Okay? On time. What is this thing we're on? And what is this thing that the clock is measuring? First of all, you just from listening to what we said, you can see how the clock structures. There's something going on here other than just a little toy.
The clock breaks down into increments, the rotation of the earth.
Okay, that's one.
Or the orbiting of the Earth and the rotation of the Earth both.
Okay, that's one thing it does. That's one thing. And it does our life. We said school day, it breaks down. Okay, our day, it gets us up. The rotation of the Earth. Okay, there's a whole lot of things that this time is doing. Tells us how fast we can drive. Okay?
Well, we didn't have time. So it regulates?
Okay, it regulates?
So we choose to let it regulate?
Yes. We choose to let it regulate? Okay, it regulates. Well, this is kind of interesting. If a person from another culture was listening to us right now, they'd be totally confused, I'm sure. And so they would hear that it regulates the rotation of the earth, the school day, gets us up in the morning, and all these kinds of things. And when we try to explain it, we refer to time. Oh, that's time. Everything exists in time. Well, let's pursue what we mean by this concept of time. Okay? We're going to really dig down into this notion of time, because you see, a lot of other cultures didn't have what we call time. Now, it just baffles them what we're talking about. In fact, they joke about us. Okay, an American Indian has clowns in their celebration because they believe joy is sacred, and they will These clowns are painted white. I'm not sure how far back that goes, whether it's pre-Columbian or not, but anyhow, they see some very funny things happening with white people, you and I. And a clown may have an alarm clock strapped there, and he's dancing around, and all of a sudden looks at it, time to be hungry, and starts grabbing food, and everybody laughs. How ridiculous. Time to be tired, lays down on the ground, goes to sleep. Oh, how dumb. This is crazy. Crazy white man. Okay, but let's see if we can really understand what we mean by time. And then what we're going to, the reason we want to do this is if we want to understand, say, the Old Testament, which is where the theology comes in, if we don't understand where we're coming from, then we're going to place judgments upon what they're saying, and what they're saying may not fit what we're trying to do to what they're saying. So let's dig into what we mean by time, and we have to say, how do we do that? How do we really come to grips with a concept of time that we have, what it really is? That's an important question. Okay. Now, I think one of the things we need is honesty. Okay, we have to really go back and say, how did we really learn what this thing was? And so, in order to do that, let's go back to when we were children. Okay? Or, if you want to reflect, then how did you really teach your children what time was? Okay, do you remember when you saw clocks, when you first had a watch or something? What was your reaction? Can you remember that? Huh?
Kept looking at it.
It's fascinating, right? Fascinating.
Mickey Mouse or Popeye?
Yeah, well, yeah. Probably even before that, you know, this tick, tick, you noticed it with the adults. Fascinating toy, right? Little toy. That's really what it was. You had a lot of toys, right? But you kept this one. Okay, that's the other toys, what happened to the other toys? They got broken. And what happens to all toys, usually, if they don't get broken with kids?
You
outlive them. Right?
Right, they get retired.
They get retired. You get bored with them, right? Our kids are always boring. You know, these kids, this is boring. You know, they get tired of that. But the interesting thing, were you allowed to get bored with clocks?
It's reinforced.
Now see, that was somehow a toy that you weren't allowed. There was something serious in all this. That was the one toy that just didn't get put away as you outgrew it. And everybody had them. And do you remember the frustration of that you didn't want to play with it anymore, but somehow you had to learn the difference between 4:15 and 3:45? Very hard, very hard. Remember that. Well, there's some other events that you can remember, and my boys have helped me on that. And I'd like you to see if you can get in your head, get back to when you were a child, thinking about how you learned that. And picture yourself now as a person who's very bright, because children are very bright, and they can figure things out. They just don't figure it out the way we figure it out. So you can't put them down as somehow simpletons. They're very bright, and they figure things out very, very profoundly, but not the way we do, and that puts them in a problem because we're bigger than they are. Okay, and that's the relationship. Okay, now here's a child comes up to the adult. The child says, I'm hungry. The adult says, but it's only 4:30.
Conditioning.
Now that's crazy. So that child says, well, what's 4:30?
It's when you're not hungry.
No, that's when the big hand's on the 6 and the little hand's between the 4 and the 5. Somehow that's supposed to make sense. Does it make sense? But what does the child do at that time? Say, I can't even get away from the word time. What does the child do? 4:30. Big hand, little. What does that have to do? My stomach is grumbling. What does the child do?
Wants a piece of bread with sugar on it.
Okay. Well, at that point, the child keeps quiet, usually. Because as my kids told me, when you're a kid, you're allowed two whys. If you go to the third one, you're probably going to get in trouble. Right? You know, and you've experienced that. Why? Remember the kids? Why? Third time. Why? Because that's the way it is. Right? So you learn time in kind of a crazy way. You had to go to bed, and I can remember this. 8 o'clock was when you went to bed. Suppose it was 9 o'clock. What happened then? What happened then if it was 9 o'clock and you weren't in bed? Trouble. See, you were in trouble. A clock wasn't in trouble for being early. You were in trouble for somehow that you were supposed to be doing something that you weren't doing. Okay? So the fact of the matter is, we learn time, what time was, as a discipline, a form of discipline, a form of order. That's how we learned it. Okay? So behind the concept of time, we're trying to get behind it, this word time. There are certain words that are very important to us, and this is, one of them is order. Okay? Very important to us, and we use the clock to maintain order. Okay, and you found that out as a child, and part of that, of course, was control. That was another important word. It was imposed on you as a form of control. Now, does that fit your experience? We said what we're going to get at the root of what we mean by the concept of time, and what we need to do is dig down to the actual experience that we've had and try, and we have to go back to a child because it's been forgotten. The experience has been forgotten. We've just taken time as for granted. We have to dig back. Is that kind of fit? That fit your experience? Fit your experience? Okay. Now, it also was a very exacting or precise control. See, I'm not a great speller, so we have three words here: order, control, and precision, or to be precise. And that was important, right? Okay. And there were many times, and someone brought up in the last session we had last week that when a family gets going and they say, well, we've got to get going in 5 minutes to make it on a trip or something, and it quite often takes a half an hour. What happens to the emotional state? Tension rises, right? Even when they're going on a vacation, this happens. Okay? Well, I mean, the vacation is to get away from it all, and so you're a half an hour late when you leave. Somehow, this control and you decided to leave at 9 o'clock, and now it's 9:30, and the tension rises. Well, kids pick that up. They see that, and that's how they learn. Through the tension, through the looks that people give them, and they learn what time is. They learn it's a precise device and way for control and order. Okay, that fit everyone's experience. Now, there are other experiences that we have with regard to time. We're told to use time. In fact, there are certain words that happen. I imagine a kid listening in or a person from another planet. They're in at a session. Here's a typical response in a Koinonia session. The speakers speak too much, okay? And they announce in the beginning, I'm only going to talk for half an hour and then let you talk, and then they talk for an hour. And then the bell rings, and they say, well, I'm sorry I used up too much of your time, but... And, you know, if there's a visitor from another planet, they say, well, if you took too much of their time, why don't you give it back and we'll get on with the discussion? Time isn't that kind of thing, right? We use time, and we're supposed to use time efficiently, right? You hear that. What does that mean to us when we say, use time efficiently? What does that mean? Let's find out the meaning of the word. Okay? What does that mean? What does it really mean? Does it mean like use the wood efficiently?
In a sense it does. We're given a given amount of time, and if a person seems to be well organized in terms of the time achievement relationship, then you can get so much more done with that amount of time.
Then you can get so much more done.
So time and work is highly related.
time and work. But what about like the wood? I mean, if we use up too much wood, we go out and cut some more and stack it up out there. Can we do that with time?
No, you don't always go out and get more wood, because sometimes
somebody did.
I know, but if you have only so much time, then you have a time for wood gathering, you have time for something else, and any resource becomes a commodity that is also precious, like wood, and I mean like time. So I'm just adding another dimension to that.
Okay, but in technology, one of the things we notice is that, all right, time is a resource. Mm-hmm. But one of the things about the wood is we can replace that with electricity for warmth. Substitutability economists like that. Or coal. Can we do that with time? What do we substitute it for? What do we mean by that? What do you feel when someone says, be efficient, be productive, or you're wasting time? What does that mean to you? What is the feeling you get?
Yield.
They want something from me.
They want something from me. Okay. So when we say use time, you're wasting time, that's an injunction on you. Okay? It's not that somehow, well, you've got this bag here and it's got a hole in it and all this time is falling out of it, so you better go collect it up and get a better bag. It's not like, hey, you're wasting coal. You know, you could say that if you're wasting coal. You have this bag of coal and someone's falling out, and they say, ah, you're wasting coal. When you say you waste time, it's an injunction on you to get going. Yes?
Well, time is an individual commodity, but when we say wasting time, it's when we are doing it in a joint process.
But we
people don't waste time as an individual.
That guilt pressure is not put on them by the individual. The guilt pressure is put on them by a group.
Well, we put it on ourselves because we're in a society that somehow this says something about our society.
Well, okay, I've lived a long time in societies that time is not very important.
All right, that's a different experience, though, than most of us have had. And so, therefore, what your experience is in that other culture is different than what we experience. Okay, that's important. So we
alternates.
There are alternatives, and that's an important thing to recognize, because we tend to treat time as though it's given to us by nature.
But sometimes we feel guilty, but then if we're in a group and someone that's always late, you never can start on time. Is one certain people always late? Then I get angry because they're wasting my time at that point, and it's just the opposite. The guilt is on them then.
Oh, okay. This kind of this. Does that fit?
Yeah.
Okay, there's a social discipline then. And what you're saying is in some cultures that's not there.
You're right.
It's
not important.
Okay, some cultures that's not. But in our culture, it is, and we can feel it the way we respond to kids or someone shows up late. They are disrupting the order. They are not controlling themselves in the precise way, and they're getting here at 5 after rather than at 4 o'clock. Now, but the efficiency. The word efficiency and the word productivity, productive, they mean you ought to get going and do some more. Don't waste time. Be efficient. That means you ought to start moving. As my kids said, I asked them, I said, well, what do you mean if they say don't waste time, be efficient? Because that means I ought to get going. Okay? You notice here again, when we refer to time, such as don't waste your time, it refers back to our behavior, okay? And when we say someone is wasting time, it refers to their behavior. Like you said, they disrupted the order. They were not precise in control, and we're consequently we're losing productivity. We're wasting time. You see, the word time comes back and reflects upon our behavior and the expectations that we place on other people. It's not this thing that's somehow given to us by nature that we go out and measure. I mean, sure, the Earth rotates with a certain regularity, but scientists tell us that the rotation of the Earth is getting, I don't know whether it's longer or shorter, but it's actually changing. And how would they measure that? What scale would they use? We get into problems here. Right, and we could get into the way science treats time, but I'd like to get a little bit more that somehow the experience of time as we've actually experienced it, as you've actually described it. Here are all these people gathered, and now we begin to feel like we're wasting, you know, they're wasting time, and we lay a guilt trip on them. And if we're late, we lay the guilt trip on us, ourselves. Frustration. Okay? Yes?
That kind of opens up that other big door where in our technology age, time is money.
Oh, yeah. We attach a precise measure so we can control it better, and the money, or the measure is usually in terms of dollars. We can get into the relationship between time and dollars and power. Really, dollars are a form of power. You can see how the relationship of time to dollars is going to happen. If we have this as social expectations for order, control, and precision, and productivity and efficiency, you can see how the units of power, dollars, are bound to be related to this. I mean, a dollar is kind of like a power certificate. It gives so much control to people. You can see that. Now, there's one other word that I'd like to add to our list here, and that's called objectivity, or objectivity. And that you hear this, well, be objective. And the time is, clock time is objective time. And you can run a very simple experiment, and you can hold up a clock, and no matter what you do, it's not going to change what it does. See, objective means you look at something as the detached observer. You don't influence it. Okay? You don't come into it with your prejudices, with your feelings. So time goes on regardless of what we do. Okay? And that's kind of related to this concept of wasting time. It's going to go on regardless of what we do, so you better get going so you don't waste this valuable resource. Okay? You get the concept. Okay, now what I suggest to you is that the concept time and the way we actually use it reflects a background of expectations that we place upon each other. It's not something given to us by nature. Okay, it's not something like a rock. You pick it up and see it. Okay, it reflects the kind of expectations that in our culture we hold to be important. We hold to be important. And we hold them to be important not because someone's forcing us to do it, or not because they've been written as so many commandments. We hold them to be important in our practices, our day-to-day practices, what we take to be natural and obvious, such as time. But they are expectations, and I think you've hit on it, you know. If they're late, we place a social expectation, a guilt trip maybe on them. Now, the character of the expectations that we share, character of these expectations, we've identified some of these. These are things that in practice our culture holds to be important. Order, control, precision, efficiency, productivity, objectivity. And I think we could add another one, that if we didn't do all these things, we wouldn't be able to solve problems. So solving problems is another important. And solving problems means getting some sort of order to be able to control the situation in a precise and objective way so we can get on with a more efficient and productive behavior. That's what a solution of a problem is, you see. So what we have here is kind of a framework that we live within. We live within. A background of expectations that we take for granted. And your point that other cultures, they don't have these, they may not have these as being as important. There may, instead of objectivity, involvement might be more important. And feelings, instead of precision, mystery might be more important. And paradox might be more important to them. But because these are important to us, we strap watches, clocks to our bodies and have them peering over our rooms because they allow us to be orderly, controlled, precise, efficient, productive, objective, and to consequently solve problems. And if we didn't have those, we would get in trouble in our society. Yeah?
Because if that manipulation of time causes a lot of other problems within our society.
Oh, yes.
The callousness and the coldness and the lack of
compassion. Right. Now you can see why we're going to try and make the connection to the theological kinds of concerns, because the theological kinds of concerns might not fit this. I think Hans will get on this. But in order to grasp the theological concerns, we have to try and come to grips with the state that we're in. And the fact of the matter is, we are in a milieu, an environment. We are like fish swimming in a water, and these are the properties of the water that we swim in. Okay? These describe some of the properties that we live within. Yes?
Just a little spin-off that just came to me. The daylight saving time, using this objective thing to make us feel we're not getting up so early when we are, is a subjective ramification.
And that allows us to get up so the daylight lasts longer so we can be more productive. Now, let's not get into the trap that's saying to judge this. That's not our purpose right now, to judge whether this is good or bad. Obviously, if you go in and you're going to have a brain surgeon work on your brain, you hope that he's going to be precise and orderly and so forth and so on when they go in there and do that. So let's not knock this as being bad. In fact, quite the opposite. We, as a culture, are very good at these things. Very, very good. That's why we have electric lights. That's why we have
ultras.
A whole lot of things. We have all these technological things we have. We're good at that. And that's the reason why we have to discuss the limitations of it. Because we are so good at it. And it is so powerful. To transform the whole world, physical world, certainly, and more than that. Now, we should not think, however, that these behaviors can be just kind of set aside when we want to and kind of brought in when we want to and kind of, you know, well, I'm in church, I'm not going to do this, and then in real life jobs we have, I'm going to. It doesn't work that way, you see. You can't practice something all the time and then get rid of it when you choose to. Okay? Because our words are shaped by these kinds of ideas. Yeah.
Don't we choose to get rid of those, like coming to Holden?
In part, yes. I think, and that's why it's so important to have a boat ride and have it out in the wilderness, so you actually go through the experience of getting away from some of that.
You don't get rid of it.
You don't get rid of it, but in a sense, that bell rings, that's true. And if I take too much time, people will start looking at their watches. I don't mind you looking at your watches, but I don't want you to listen, put them up to your ear to see if they're still running. Okay.
Well, okay. I put my watch back on because I needed to have some concept of time so I could get to class on time. I put my watch on my desk and I was going to leave it there. But Holden runs on a schedule.
Yeah.
And I had to put my watch back on.
Okay.
So then, that schedule you have to go to for survival or meals.
Right. But I don't want to miss anything either.
That's the only part of the schedule that I get irritated at.
Well, I can appreciate from being on a dish team why they need that. You see how much work. There is a reason for that. Now,
but
I don't.
This discussion would never take place if you didn't have a precise time to start, but at least so that we're more or less here at the same time, within 10 minutes. You know, my daughter's in graduate school down south, and going from the northwest to the south was a real experience. Class, it says right in the catalog of a major university, classes will start within 10 minutes after their schedule, or something like this. In other words, it's a much more relaxed concept of time in the South than it was in her culture of the Northwest. But here, that's Vanderbilt University, where the classes, you're going to start well in the hour, but within 10 minutes.
Okay. Now,
so you're not precise. You're floating.
Well, 10 minutes.
But we need it.
The Navajo would be amazed at the precision. I mean, they might come up, when the moon is full or something, which gives you a certain amount of latitude.
But we wouldn't be able to have a discussion like this.
Well, In our culture, we wouldn't be able to, because we've set things to require a certain precision and a certain order, because it's been important.
Yeah.
Now, if we were living here and we were just kind of, we weren't in such a rush, we'd eventually get around to talking these things whenever it felt like it was the time to talk about things. Time would be not at 10:45. What time would you talk about things? At talking time. That's what time. Okay, you see what I mean? When it was time to talk about things, you would talk about things, and it would happen. See, there's a difference. The difference has to do with order and control would not be that important, and efficiency. It would happen.
But I doubt if I'd be there.
In this culture, that's probably true, and what that reflects is the degree to which our behavior has been shaped by this. Our behavior, our words, our perceptions, all of this has been shaped by this background of expectations. And that's what I think we can learn from a study of the concept of time, that these kinds of things have shaped our behavior, have shaped our words, and that allows us to do certain things, but maybe we're missing some other things. Okay?
Like sensitivity.
Sensitivity, joy, celebration, caring, love, forgiveness, and so forth and so on. These are things that don't quite fit into here, and I think there's a danger to kind of consider those kinds of words as describing things somehow a little less real. Okay? Forgiving is not quite the same kind of action as, say, hammering a nail. Okay? There's something very definite about that. You know? Whereas forgiving, we say, is subjective. It involves your feelings. And that's kind of a way of treating it is not quite as real. There may be other cultures, however, where that was more real, and all of this stuff was kind of less real. Yes?
Well, things like an education or human behavior, you know, you say this age so-and-so should learn how to read, and this age so-and-so should learn how to do division, and so on and so forth. That's not true. But that's what our culture tries to, and we get all sorts of warped out kids in schools because they're supposed to learn something at a particular time.
If you can't measure it, it didn't happen.
Yeah, that's exactly what we tend to do. Treat things as real is what you can measure. And why? Because a measurement provides an objective and precise and orderly categorization of something. Okay? Precise, orderly. Now, let's see if we can maybe grasp why these things might be actually limited. And that maybe the reality, I'm not talking about subjective feelings, but there's a reality that's much more than this. I mean, why should the real world simply conform to the expectations we place on it? I mean, that's kind of arrogant. Let's suppose I wanted to tell you about the meaningfulness of a friendship that I had. Okay? How would I do that? Say, I want to really say this is special. How would I do that? Stop and think. How would I actually have to do that?
Putting in a point in time when you had this experience, probably.
A point in time when I had this experience? No.
I think that we are extremely limited in our vocabulary to express those intangible things.
Okay.
I mean, if I had a real good friendship with you, as an experiential type of thing, and someone else has to experience something like to even be able to identify with it.
All right. Now, does that reflect, you said intangible things, like a good friendship. Does that reflect that the friendship itself, the experience of friendship, is intangible or somehow unreal?
I don't equate intangibility with non-reality.
Okay. So then what it really reflects is our ability to share that kind of thing. And why? Because this is the basis by which our words have evolved. You see, it's intangible, which means it's not, you can't precisely put your finger on it. Now that's our problem. That doesn't mean that thing is unreal. Well, let's get back now. I'm going to push you a little harder. Let's suppose you still wanted to, nevertheless, tell someone about the reality of that specialness and that friendship, the meaningfulness, how would you do it? What would you do?
Well, the only thing you can do is try to tap some similar experience that they've had and say that reality may be similar to that.
Okay, and how would you do that? You want to tap some other experience. How would you do that?
Express your own.
Express your own, and how would you express it?
We're in a circle.
Description of feelings.
Expression of feelings. And how would you do that? How would you actually come out and what would you start? How would you communicate that?
When I'm with that person, time just flies.
Okay. Right, okay, but I'm still going to push it. How would you go ahead and convince or try to communicate the reality of the specialness of that friendship? What would you do?
There you go.
You tell a story. You see? And that story would demand the person get involved in it. Someone else had, I think that's kind of what you were saying. With feeling, you would tell a story in which you got involved in it with feeling, and you'd be violating this, by the way, because you wouldn't be objective standing if the person was, for example, let's suppose I responded to your story and you said, well, I remember one day when my son was sick. And that would be a way you would start out a story. And suppose I said, well, which day was it? What was the diagnosis of that sickness? You see, I want some precise and objective information about what it is you're telling me. Okay? And suppose I kept doing that every time you said a sentence. I kept saying, I want to know, really, in terms of, you know, I want to get a good, objective, precise way. And then I keep saying to you, well, get to the point. Don't waste my time. Come on, get to the point. So get to the point. That's precise and efficient. That implies all of those things. How would you respond to me?
Goodbye.
Goodbye. You say, nutsy, I can't communicate that.
Exactly.
Now, do you get where I'm heading? If you want to go ahead and talk about something really special, you find yourself in our culture having to violate this. Actually having to violate this. And it becomes difficult, and as you say, we have a hard time doing it because we're so used to doing this. And it becomes intangible and we fumble around and so forth and so on. Okay? Okay, you got where we are. We're in here. We've experienced this by reflecting on our experience, and I pushed you and said, how would you really talk about something really special? And you said you have to violate this and tell story, and a person would have to get involved in that story with feeling, right? So that all fits your experience. And if they insisted on doing this, you'd get mad at them and you'd leave them, right? That all fits your experience. That all fits your experience. Okay, now, I want to throw it over to Hans here. And what does that have to say about the Bible? Or what does that have to say about our practice of religion? You want to respond to that? He's not ready for that.
I'm not ready for this, but it's an interesting curveball. Let me start out by saying that we live in a world of story in the Bible. And we just take it for granted that that's the world you live in. And we tell our little stories Sunday morning from 9 o'clock to 10, and then a little bell rings, and even if it's really exciting, we stop telling the story.
This stuff keeps popping up.
And then we go on to another bigger room, and the kids are ho-humming it for when the adults are doing their thing, and there's some story, but it's not quite as boring. And then after an hour of that, we go home and we get back in this world again.
So we have a problem then, maybe, and this is what you were saying about it becomes intangible, it becomes very difficult to communicate through story because we're always trying to do this kind of thing to it, so it's harder for us to get the meaning of what was being said in the story because we tend to do this thing, tend to look for this precise order and objectivity and so forth and so on.
Right. The theologians want to right away suck the meaning out of the story. And they want to say, well, this is what it means, and let me tell you what it means. Rarely do we, when we preach, say, I want to tell you a story. Just sit back and enjoy this story.
So the theologians are trying to do some of this too?
Exactly. I'm afraid we're trapped by it. It's a frightening indictment. We're trapped by the same technological background. Is that true? Is that our experience in churches?
I'll be definitely.
I was going to say the same thing. If you go to churches in the third world, they go on and on and on and on. And the local people don't get bored because their expectation is that it will go on.
How do you feel about that as a Westerner when they go on and on like that?
You're checking your watch and thinking, when is this guy ever going to stop? It's been an hour and 45 minutes.
Some of us are acquainted with a dead now pastor, Dr. Youngo. In Minneapolis, I think he became famous because he had six services on Sunday morning and 12-minute sermons. He really made it desirable to go to church.
It was efficient.
Yeah, it was very productive. Yeah, right. Very orderly, precise. Well, of course, so we've got a problem here. It appears to me we've got a serious problem. Because remember when I said, suppose I kept asking you to be precise, be orderly, and so forth, and you were telling the story, what did you say you'd do if I did that?
Leave.
You'd leave! Now, you see the problem, the theological problem. The meaning may leave us. Now, fortunately, God is a little more patient than most of us are. Yeah. And then I'll get to you next.
Just to throw another curve, I've been thinking about, you said, how do you relate this special friendship? Well, we really get ourselves into binds if somebody has experienced a real tragedy. Their brother has died, their mother has died, it's the death of a relationship, there's been a divorce. You want to really relate to that person, and you come up with the most asinine comments, and the person is blowing their mind, and they have to deal with you too.
That's true.
You know, because we aren't used to saying, sitting down and saying the story of, well, I personally had a house fire, for example, and somebody could come up to me and say, we had one of those 2 years ago, and I know what you're going through. And that was sufficient.
Because you knew that person could be involved some way in the experience. It wasn't they were giving you objective facts.
Or somebody else in the in our group has lost a brother and relates all of the weird things that people are bringing, or the offbeat theology being brought into it. You know, having to pigeonhole everything.
When we get into the spiritual aspect, I think the word stewardship certainly has a big place in our consideration of time. We should be good stewards of our time.
That's right.
Can you discuss that?
Maybe we should just be good stewards. Let's not say of our time, because as soon as we say of our time, then we're back to this. Because remember, time isn't really something. There's a gift of being that we have given to us. As soon as we say time, we're starting to throw a word on that has all of these meanings to it. Now, sometimes we have to do that because that's our language. We are in this world and we can't escape from all of this. But what I'm saying is we have a problem here. Does everybody see that we have a problem? That's what we want to get at this stage, and then we're going to wrestle with that a little bit more tomorrow. We have a problem in that we're in this and it's in us. And as you were saying, we reinforce that on other people. But when we're down to really explain or trying to convey something that's really real to us, and it is something that is very special, then this doesn't work. And if a person insists on this, we tend to say, well, bug off, leave. You get very frustrated.
Yeah. I think one of the most effective ways we communicate our friendship with somebody is when we forget all of that on the board and give them our time.
That's right.
This person who is in need of consoling or whatever, we're just present and we're with them and we're forgetting our schedule and everything else.
That's right.
Then we're communicating our friendship.
But how often do you do that? I keep hearing about this ethics here on the board, but how often do you interact with people on that level? You don't, because of this.
Isn't that where setting a priority comes in? And I find myself in conflict with that a lot as a school teacher. You know, a kid, for example, the last 5 minutes of the period breaks down and you need to go sit down one-on-one and talk to that student. But instead, the bell is ringing and you've got 30 new kids. And sometimes that it's hard to, that conflict between the social priority and the human.
That's right.
That's really neat. You know, that ties in with what we're going to get into a lot more tomorrow, the whole question of time as choice. And I think what we want to experience today is the frustration of the time and how all of us, I want to say, Dave, I don't know if this is the way to put the question, but don't we idolatrize time? Don't we worship time? Don't we obey it no matter what? Example, supposing we're having an exciting discussion. Now, supposing this thing stops at 11:45. Right? Isn't that when we stop? And we're really excited. What are we all going to do? We're going to get up and walk out.
We'll get fidgety. Even if we do skip lunch, we'll get fidgety.
Right.
Because it
sure.
doesn't fit.
Right. We'll say, even it's really exciting and it's terrific and I'd really like to stay here. And if I do what I want to do, I'd stay here. But it's time to go to lunch, so we'll break off the most exciting discussion. Or turn it around. Let's supposing it's a ho-hum thing. Right? We'll all stay here.
Stick it out.
I mean, we really worship this beast. This is what I want to say. I think we worship it. And now that's using religious language already.
Right.
And I'm kind of getting ahead of my story, but do you experience that too, that it has a tyranny over us?
Yes.
Yeah.
I was just thinking in terms of a relationship with your watch. When do you take it off? When do you put it on? And what kind of watch do you have? And how, you know, like, is it a computerized digital with a little alarm? You know, how deeply do you get involved with time to the point of what you choose to wear every day? And when you wear, I find that I look at people's wrists and I find I make a judgment about their personality.
In other words, it's the key to understanding the person.
There's an important thing that Hans brought up. He says we find ourselves, when we're coming to grips with this, using religious language. Is there any other language that we can come to grips with this with? I don't think so. I don't think they're really, we're almost forced, you see, the paradox by forcing this on us. And not that this is necessarily bad, but it's, we use the term idolatrous. And I used the word last time, demonic. Demonic. Now, I mean, talk about a non-technological word. We don't understand it very well because we tend to think of demons as these little critters with horns and running around with pitchforks. When we say, ho, 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 isn't that ridiculous? And it's a nice way of this kind of background discrediting the language of the religious. Well, the demonic, Tillich says, is always associated with the good. It is. And it's where a means or a vehicle to goodness becomes overextended until it becomes the substitute for goodness itself. You see? And that's what I think has happened here. You see, it's not wrong to be efficient. Certainly if you bring a patient into the hospital and they're in critical shape and they're orderly and precise and efficient and productive, I mean, you know, I don't want them to hang loose. Okay. So, but what happens is these become values in themselves. These become the definition of the good. Instead of saying, be efficient for this thing because that's a way of caring, we say, be efficient, period. Be productive. How many politicians are talking about increasing the productivity? Productivity of what? They never say that. So this becomes demonic. See? Yes, over here.
I was trying to think some examples of where society reinforces another type of model rather than that. And my workday is divided into appointments. And the best strokes that I get is not did I cure the problem, but she sure gave me a lot of time. And so I get a lot of positive reinforcement if I spend time with the person. So. On the other hand, the most negative strokes is she sure made me wait.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So I think our society does reinforce giving time.
So giving, and what does giving time mean?
Spending together.
That means doing something that isn't dominated by this. Okay? I mean, we gotta get around that word time. It means doing something not dominated by efficiency, order, precision, and so forth, and listening and caring. And in a sense, if this is kind of The way to not make this idolatrous or demonic is you sacrifice this at times. And so sacrifice, again, a religious word, comes in, and you sacrifice order and precision and control, and you end up sometimes in trouble because of that. But, I mean, certainly if you go to the Bible, they don't say if you sacrifice, you won't get any trouble. I mean, I don't think it says that. But you see where, again, the religious language is beginning to come in. Yes, over here.
Yeah, I just had one of those little ahas that I get every once in a while.
Good.
I work over at the Seattle Crisis Clinic, answering the phone line over there. And we deal with all sorts of emotional distress, whether it's from suicide to abuse or whatever it is. These are hurting people that call it. And so I know what the protocols are and how we deal with those and so forth, but I just clicked that the intervention that we use that's most successful that underlies this is to disassociate those people from what you have on board, okay? To get them into their feelings, their emotions, to make them be able to communicate and talk about and experience what's going on for them, rather than what they're trying to do, which is generally trying to control the situation, be precise and efficient about it and so forth, which doesn't work.
It doesn't work. Now, what is that experience of that person calling up then on a phone in a panic? And what is that experience that we will have? I mean, that is a valuable experience he shared with us. Now, if this does become demonic or idolatrous, then that experience can be, we can think of that as a gift, as a revealing, as a revelation. Okay, as a, again, we're using religious language. I don't know what kind of, how if we use this language, how to deal with it. But it is, and maybe then we begin to say, well, anxiety, for example, which these people experience, maybe that we ought to think of that not as a sickness. You see, that's what we usually do, is call it a sickness, because they're not doing this, and so what we do is we give them a pill to overcome the anxiety, and sometimes we need to do that, because they have to live in this world. I'm not putting that down. But if that's all we do, then what we're doing is saying, we'll give them a pill so as to control the situation so they can be more productive members of society. You see? And that's becoming a definition of illness now, is people who can't do this stuff very well. Okay? Okay, you see the tension that's in there.
I would imagine that many of those people who call are calling because either they've chosen not to go be ruled by this, or they have failed in being ruled by it. And I think in Sioux Falls we have a definite Indian community that have not chosen not to go with this, and so are looked on as failures and suffer all sorts of frustrations that lead to alcoholism, et cetera, et cetera. But surely it's all tied together.
And yet it may be that in terms of our day and age, they are the ones being called upon, not in terms of explaining things to us, but in their very actions and the agony that they are suffering. Maybe they're the ones calling the call to wrestle with this, the demonic side of this. Maybe. I don't know. We're going to have to look into a non-technological source to get some understanding of this. I think we've discovered we're going to need some religious language.
In how this is developed, how much, you know, for example, I think interesting study would be, how much is involved with the Industrial Revolution? And how much, you know, the production line? And then, the other hand, how some businesses are trying to break this down. I think Weyerhaeuser is one of those that has really done some steps, at least in certain positions. There is no time that you have to be exactly at work. They have the weight rooms, they have the jogging paths. Whenever you want to, you take off, just so you get your work done. But it does not have to be on the precise 8 o'clock in the morning schedule. And there are other businesses that are doing, but some businesses obviously can't. And that would be a very interesting study. There's a sociological background.
I've read some of the literature on that. I would say, though, that I would not automatically assume that they're not trying to do this. I think when it comes down to the bottom line of why they're doing this is because it makes them more efficient and productive, and you really end up with a more orderly process.
But it's production with in a different way.
But
in how much in at a different time.
I would say that what it is largely a response to authoritarian control.
Okay.
And it's depending more upon the self-control of individuals and peers. It still has the background of control. And I'll give one example, is the movie 9 to 5. How many have seen that movie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's a group of secretaries, and they are working in an organization where their boss is horribly chauvinistic. I mean, he is just horrible and incompetent. And well, in a bizarre series of events, they kidnap the boss. And they lock him up in his own house for several months or a long period of time. And what no one notices that he's missing. And then they bring about all these reforms, such as a daycare center and job sharing and alcoholics program and so forth and so on. And then he escapes, and he's just about ready to expose them. But what happens in the end of the story?
Congratulations.
Promoted out of the office.
It turns out this stuff works.
Yeah.
Okay? And what is it? And that's the justification. If you notice in the story, that was the justification. It worked. Suppose it didn't work.
Then good luck.
Then they would have been sent to jail and so forth. But it worked. And what does it works mean?
Productivity.
It was more productive. It was more orderly. It was all of this kind of stuff. And why did they resent their boss? What was a large part of their resentment of the boss? Is because they'd do the work and he'd get the credit. He really wasn't that efficient, orderly, productive, and all the rest of that, as well as being a clod. I mean, and you find this a lot in organizations now, is the resentment of the superior because they're not doing this kind of thing. And they're getting the credit for doing it, and you've got to cover up for them.
How many times is that, bro?
Huh? What is that?
His alarm went off.
His alarm went off.
Poetic justice. Question, to eat or not to eat?
Okay, up here. We'll get up here.
I remind of a couple things, I guess. I think about the book, Type A Personality. The difference between the two types of personality, supposedly vast gross overgeneralization, but the type A people that are always looking at their watches and so on, which is efficiency. And then I'm reminded of a story, I think it's an obvious about a bishop, a Catholic bishop, who was a very, very busy man and became very frustrated in his work because he had so many interruptions until one day he finally realized that his interruptions were his work.
Yes,
Mark. I'm wondering how, in all of our discussion, the shadow of the reality of death influences our whole concept of time. Behind everything, we are aging. Time for us seems to be running out, and one day it will stop, at least as we know it. And I wonder how that somehow is an impetus. Pushes our concept of time.
Or the fear of it.
The fear, yeah. And I wonder, for instance, you know, when we were talking before, what would happen if we would not die? You know, life would continue and continue and continue. As a, for instance, how would that change our whole concept of time and its value and the way that we dealt with it? I wonder.
That's a whole other topic. We could really, you know, the relationship to that to death. It certainly is a question that comes up.
Yeah, but it's only if it's linear.
Uh huh.
I mean, you have to ask what is the notion of time
exactly.
There.
Again, we're back to that, and the notion of time has to do with the behaviors and expectations. It's a reflection of the behaviors and expectations that we place upon people. And it is bound to shape our concept of death. It's bound to shape our concept of life, which may be even more scary than our concept of death. And it's bound to shape the words that we have. It's bound to go ahead and shape what we treat as being really real. Okay? For example, we say that what happens in the past you can't change. That reflects our concept of time. All right? Can you change the past? You say, well, no. Well, doesn't forgiveness change the past, the significance of it? Well, you see, by saying, having in our notion that you can't change things in the past, we treat forgiveness as kind of not really real kind of action, you see, because we've got to put it into this framework of time. You say, oh, but we can change the significance and meaning of what happened through forgiveness and repentance. Like, well, you know what happened. And then we say, oh, but you can't change the time. And what we're really saying is, well, significance and meaning really aren't real things. You see, that's the way we accommodate it. You see, because of our concept of time. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, over here, and then we'll...
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I think in terms of alternatives to this today, we've really kind of beat around the bush, and part of that has to do with linguistics, and linguistics being reflected by our culture.
Right.
Now, we will try to go into theology apparently tomorrow, but that is the language of another culture, and the translations are nearly impossible. And with our culture, we just have no way to deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
We have no language for it.
That's right.
And so we sat here, and we've talked about time quite well, but alternatives, for myself, I think we've kind of fallen flat in our face.
Okay, now we have to grasp that. That's the purpose of this session, to grasp the predicament that we're in, that we are trapped in this, and that we've got to go back to this. All right, there are stories there, but we tend to structure these things, and even if we try not to, because our language has been shaped by this. And those stories are going to have a tendency to go away, just like you were saying. You know, when I broke into your stories, you'd say, well, I just leave them. That's going to be the tendency of the meaning of the story to go away from us. Okay? And we're going to have to struggle with that. You see? And that's the purpose of this session right now, is to reach us up to the point of this paradox and say, what can we do if we're caught in this? Our language is caught in this. Our whole sense of reality, our sense of who we are. And we reinforce that in others, as you pointed out. We do that in each other's, and we put ourselves in guilt trips, and we're caught in these paradoxes. How can we possibly grasp the meaning of stories that were written in a time when this wasn't important? Certainly not as important. That's the paradox we want to end with in this session, where we're faced with a crisis. And that's the one where we may be ready then to try and do some theological work. Okay? Is that?
We only have a 60-minute page, so your time's about up.
Oh, okay.
Before you go.
Hey, I knew that the time...
Over.
Wait a minute.
No, we don't need tape.
I knew that the time was up, and you know how I knew that?
Fidgeting.
The fidgeting. You notice everybody putting on their jacket? No, I noticed the fidgeting, and I could feel it in my bones. Go ahead.
Right. Before you go, I want to say a couple of things. When I teach, my students always tell me, you say the best things after the bell rings. Now, I don't know what that says about me, but it tells me that we always have a time problem at the end of things, and that relates to death. I think that's a very significant question. I have a couple of assignment questions for you now. One of them, I want you to ask yourselves, how does Scripture deal with time? Okay? And how seriously does it take time? So that's one kind of question. Another one, is there anything in Scripture comparable to this? Like, is there a pre-technology society technology that needs to be attacked? Can you think about that? And then another thing is, we tend to trivialize story, right? That's for children, story time, it's relaxed time, et cetera, et cetera. It's entertainment. The last question is, how do you take story seriously? What is our avenue to taking story seriously today, so that we can start building some bridges from a very trivial activity, telling stories, listening to stories, to the critical questions that we're wrestling with that Dave kind